This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Garrett Hawkins, president of the Missouri Farm Bureau Federation. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by Syngenta, working with farmers to meet the challenges of the day. Learn more at syngenta-us.com. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Garrett Hawkins next. At Syngenta, we talk to U.S. farmers and growers every day to hear their concerns and help them meet their challenges. From research and development to create innovative products to digital solutions to reduce water use and create healthy soil. We work hand in hand with America's men and women who feed and power the world. Our highly skilled teams are at the forefront of connecting technology to utilize mobile apps, aerial imagery, and other advances to enable farmers and growers to make smart application and buying decisions for their farms. When our farmers have a successful crop, we all benefit. And Syngenta is proud to work alongside farmers to help them make the best decisions now and the future of their farm. Learn more about Syngenta and our support of the U.S. farmer online at syngenta-us.com. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Missouri Farm Bureau President Garrett Hawkins says his state, like others, is facing a challenging farm economy with a safety net that is in no way reflective of the financial circumstances farmers face today. Hawkins also says farmers and landowners are feeling the impact of the previous administration's one-sided approach to the nation's energy future.
Jeff, the last few years, let's face it, all of the eggs have been put in one basket when it comes to federal energy policy. We saw an administration that was solely focused on green energy handouts and finding ways to implement the Green New Deal, not by passing legislation in Congress, but by using executive orders, as well as big balloon type bills like the Inflation Reduction Act, as well as the IIJA as the vehicle to achieve these green energy dreams. The reality is it has jeopardized national security. It's clearly jeopardized energy security, and it jeopardizes food security because of the pressure that comes along with particularly putting in place solar farms, that are taking prime farm ground out of production. So here's the deal. Within Farm Bureau, for as long as I can remember, we have always supported an all-of-the-above comprehensive approach to domestic energy production. And we have always said that it's not just traditional energy like oil and gas, as well as alternative like nuclear, but we need renewables, right? That's why we've supported the renewable fuel standard. That's why we're so excited about the next generation of biofuels and the opportunity to partner with the aviation sector through SAF. And yes, wind and solar have a place. But what we have seen is an administration that put out $400 billion of green energy goodies to push this. And ultimately, it has destabilized the grid. Because guess what? We are taking reliable baseload power generation offline faster than we can put intermittent sources like solar and wind on. So when you hear more about blackout and brownouts, well, guess what? We've caused it. When we put all of our eggs in one basket and say we're going to flip the switch and go to renewables and that we're going to go to an overarching EV policy on this country, we don't have the infrastructure to do all this. This is why we're talking about new transmission projects that, in some cases, trample on private property rights. That's why you're seeing neighbor against neighbor on solar projects, because of all this subsidy and push in this area, it has created so much consternation. And that's my hope, that in the weeks and months ahead, we're going to get back to the fundamentals in this country and a position of energy dominance that looks at all sources of energy.
During the time that ethanol was growing, there was support from Washington. There were subsidies that was available in the ethanol industry. And in order for sustainable aviation fuel, we talked about that last week on this program. We could talk about it more here today. It's not economically feasible. The SAF, if we were making it commercially today, would be about three times the price of regular fuel. It's going to take time to grow that industry and to bring it about.
But if we look at electricity, one of the big issues that have taken place in so many different states is talking about individual property rights. And a solar company comes in and offers a high dollar per acre, to someone for 1,000 or more acres of land. They're being subsidized by Washington. The people who are driving electric cars are being subsidized by Washington to drive those cars. So what you feed grows and what you starve dies.
I think California continues to be a great case study of what these green energy dreams result in. The statistics now are 1 in 4 Californians can't pay their electric bill, right? Because they have skewed their policy so far one direction and taken offline reliable baseload power that now they're talking about, well, we need to move away from a consumption-based utility structure to something else to try to spread the costs, right? That's what happens when you skew policy a certain direction. Or when you want to ban the combustible engine by 2035 in California and force everyone to EVs. Well, guess what? We're still not there in terms of being able to haul goods via EV semi-trucks, right? You read the articles, and it is insane how much more cost and time is associated with trying to move goods. Just the other day, visiting with my colleagues, the Northeast State Farm Bureau presidents, where policies have skewed towards EVs, they face the trouble of the trucks that are out there now aren't getting the job done for what they need for their segments of agriculture. And they're like, we've got to do something within our states to roll back these policies that have gone too far. And that's the thing. Within Farm Bureau, we're a reasonable group of folks, but we as a nation, we are focused on trying to help drive conversation to get us back to a balanced approach to energy. And that's where solar, you know, again, solar has a place. And I get it. For some of our farmers and landowners, that opportunity to sign a solar contract may just be that family's 401k. So I understand the private property rights aspect. What we question is what's driving this, and that's $400 billion worth of green energy handouts that are skewing energy policy too far.
So the question then will be, how does this Trump administration sort those green energy policies? What do they keep? What do they throw away? When we talk to Jim Matheson with the NRECA, the biggest demand for electrical load is not electric vehicles. It's artificial intelligence.
Right.
And then you ask, what has been the catalyst for growth in the S&P 500 and other financials? It's been artificial intelligence. So we are moving rapidly in that direction. And Matheson shared that not only is the question of the available electrical supply, the base load, questionable, but the transmission lines across the country to carry that volume of electricity to these different places is in question.
That's right. And again, you think about it, in Missouri, little did we know that in Missouri, we were the precursor to the Green New Deal for an experiment called the Grain Belt Express. You know, for those who haven't heard about it, the Grain Belt Express was at one time owned or going to be developed by a company called Clean Line. It's now owned by Invenergy, that's Chicago-based. But essentially, the Grain Belt Express is a private, for-profit entity building a mega transmission line from western Kansas to the Indiana border and ultimately to get into the lucrative electricity markets on the eastern seaboard, right, where consumers are demanding. They want their green energy dreams fulfilled, right? They want to know that it's coming from wind and solar. So Grain Belt Express, this concept starts in 2014 in Missouri, and 10 years later, this is still an ongoing frustration and point of consternation with landowners across northern Missouri. Because in our instance, we had a public service commission that ultimately, when Grain Belt went to them not once but twice, but ultimately three times to get a CCN, a Certificate of Convenience and Necessity, ultimately they were given, as a private company, the power of eminent domain to come in and condemn and acquire easements to develop this project that only they are going to profit from. Now, ultimately in the conversation, they finally agreed to drop some power into Missouri. But when this concept started, Missouri was simply going to be a pass-through territory for this for-profit project. And so we're in new territory now, not just investor-owned utilities that we're accustomed to developing transmission projects. Now we've got for-profit entities who are entering this space, and they're going to profit on the backs of landowners. And guess what? Landowners for decades, because we wanted electricity to the farm decades ago, infrastructure was built on our backs, right? And we recognized that that had to be happen. Now, as we look at this fundamental transformation of power generation and transmission as we know it, farmers and landowners are being told yet again that you're going to bear the brunt and you're going to house this mega transmission infrastructure, not just for your lifetime, but for your kids' lifetimes as well.
Blunt question, but what's the difference between the rural electric cooperatives many years ago that brought electricity to communities across the country and what's happening today? And are they dealing fairly with landowners?
I think there's one word that I can summarize this conversation by, and that's accountability. You think about electric co-ops, they're owned by their members, right? The people that serve them in those respective territories. They have a say in electing their peers to an electric co-op board of directors versus these for-profit companies. The farmer or landowner doesn't have a say whatsoever. They're the necessity that the company has to have in order to build their infrastructure, to run those lines, and ultimately to generate the profits that they're looking for.
So, Garrett, the question now, at the passing of the Biden administration and now the installation of leadership under President Trump and Trump 2.0, what are the things that you and other agriculture groups, rural interest groups, would be and are already asking of this Trump administration?
Well, let me pick back up with the whole issue of power generation and transmission first. We've got to get back to a reliable baseload, right? We've got to talk about the tremendous resources and assets that we have as a country and get back to the fact that to do anything that we do in agriculture, manufacturing, anything as a U.S. economy, you got to have affordable, reliable baseload. And that certainly gets into the conversation of data centers and artificial intelligence as well.
So you want to fire up coal-powered plants again? Do you want to use more natural gas? Do you
all
want
of the
nuclear?
Above.
How would you?
All of the above. I think it's crazy that we're still mining coal. It's just being shipped to China. So this whole conversation around climate and we can't use coal because of that. Well, guess what? Coal is still getting burned. China is still building coal-fired plants. Who can burn it cleaner than anybody else? We can here in the United States, but certainly we have abundant natural gas supplies. That's why we're talking about exporting natural gas or liquefied natural gas. So use the resources with which we have been blessed while continuing to be smart about adding renewables as we can. But you can't take reliable baseload off faster than you're putting intermittent on and causing this mismatch. So when it comes to transmission, I want to be clear. Like, we're not opposed to enhancing the grid. We all recognize that there are shortcomings and updates that need to happen in the grid. But let's start from a point of appreciation as to who has to house this infrastructure for decades to come. That's farmers and landowners. They deserve to be compensated fairly and respected. And guess what? We've got to work around that infrastructure, and there are steps that need to be taken to make sure that ag lands are restored back to productive capability when infrastructure is built. You know, something I want to see the Trump administration do is recognize that when it comes to siting of these projects, that state authorities have primacy. What we saw during the Biden administration was an effort to take away state siting authority and therefore local landowner input and say those decisions are best made in Washington, D.C. That's what we saw with the National Interest Electric Transmission Corridor proposals. Missouri was removed from the 10 proposals. 3 are still moving forward. Now, again, what is the premise? We need to improve transmission. Absolutely. We can all agree on that. But you shouldn't do it by trampling private property rights and taking away state authorities' ability to decide what is best for their states and their landowners.
The Securities and Exchange Commission.
Oh, boy. A big ball. So, you know, you heard President Duvall, our members are so engaged. There are 3 pieces to the SEC's rule. Scope 3, think about it as the supply chain, Jeff, that in which they wanted to reach not from Wall Street, but all the way back to the farm gate with these greenhouse gas regulations. Okay, so scope three's removed. I'm certain the Trump administration is going to look at this climate disclosure rule because the cost is tremendous to the U.S. economy. But here's what people aren't talking enough about. California is moving ahead with their own climate disclosure law. I'm a part of an effort with American Farm Bureau to challenge this in federal court, because guess what? This is going to be a violation of interstate commerce, and I truly believe it is, if it is allowed to stand, the state of California is going to be responsible for driving some of the biggest consolidation in American agriculture that we have seen really since the farm crisis of the 80s.
We saw years ago a GMO labeling law that was in the Northeast that Congress did step in and overthrow. Proposition 12 was brought before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said that's a congressional issue. Congress needs to fix it. On this show a few weeks ago, we had a representative of the packing industry, the vegetable packaging, and they are seeing now different state laws with regard to how vegetables are packaged, and they're worried about a patchwork and also worried about interstate commerce. This is just another go-around.
That's why, as a part of the farm bill discussion, we have been adamant that there needs to be a Prop 12 fix, right, after the Supreme Court ruling. And then back to California climate disclosure. Like, truly, you know, let me use my farm as an example, Jeff. I'm a cow-calf producer, and all of a sudden now I'm going to have to account for every bit of greenhouse gas emission, my fuel, fertilizer, all this stuff on my farm. And it doesn't just stop there. Those records have to be passed through the supply chain. So guess what? The mom and pop, the family I do business with to market my calves, they're going to have to collect my information and pass it through the order buyers who buy my calves. All of a sudden, through the supply chain, ultimately for the Walmarts of the world or whoever's doing business in California, they've got to be able to account for those greenhouse gas emissions, or else they're going to be on the hook for lawsuits for failure to comply with this law. So what's going to happen? Those at the end of the supply chain are going to mitigate risk the best that they can, right? And ultimately, that's why I'm concerned about consolidation in the supply chain, because there's not going to be a way for small mom-and-pop livestock markets, feed stores, and others to possibly comply with all these record-keeping requirements. And for what? For California to feel good that they're doing something for the climate? This is a farce, and that's why Congress ultimately has to step in and stop this patchwork that we are seeing from states like California and New York that think that they know best.
It's not right for me to speak for the Trump administration, but headlines would suggest they have a great bit of disdain for the Green New Deal and would like to eliminate a number of those policies that were promulgated by the 118th and certainly by the Biden administration. Yet there are some pieces there that show promise. And farmers, especially of row crops, they have hoped that their feedstuffs would be acceptable and would be able to be included in producing sustainable aviation fuel and certainly renewable fuels. But in the law that it was written through the Inflation Reduction Act, 40B rules came about the time that it was over, and 45Z, all those are not in place as yet. There is an intent that's offered, but we still don't know what this Trump administration is going to offer there. So what do you hope for from this administration with regard to renewables, with regard to agriculture's role in green energy and climate?
I would say this. Start from the recognition that farmers were climate smart before climate smart was cool. Okay, let's start there. Let's start from the fact that for decades, farmers and ranchers have shown a commitment to sustainability and continuous improvement. And you have seen that when you look at the data. The data bears out that we continue to do better in agriculture. So let's start from that premise first. What gets irritating is these goals are set, whether it's for SAF or whatever, and people want to drive production practices back to the farm gate. What I want to see is a toolbox, a suite of options that begin with the premise that farmers do things really well. So you don't have to mandate specific practices to us. Let's start from the recognition that we're already doing everything that we can and continuing to enhance and adopt new technologies to do even better tomorrow and the years ahead.
One of the challenges, though, are rewarding new practices, but taking for granted those who have already been employing these climate smart practices, not for years, but for decades.
For decades. They just were never labeled climate smart, right? Take, for instance, in Missouri. We, in the 1980s, farmers, ranchers, conservationists led the conversation to enact what really was a novel and hasn't been repeated elsewhere. The concept of putting in place a 1/10 cent sales tax that's paid across the board, across all Missourians, half of which goes to state parks, the other half goes to soil and water conservation. So since the 1980s, Missourians have been taxing themselves to improve air, water, soil quality, and soil health. That's all climate smart, but was never packaged as climate smart, right? So that's the whole point, what you have said. We've been doing this stuff for decades. It's just being repackaged in a different way. So give us credit for the good things that we have been doing for some time. Start with that base level recognition that farmers inherently want to do good in how we manage our resources. That's where the conversation should start.
You've challenged a number of different areas. So now show me a path to solutions. What are things that you hope for, things to be considered, and a path of progress that to you would make sense?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, you see the president doing what he said he was going to do, and that's putting in place executive orders to unleash American energy dominance, as he says, right? So everything that we touch in agriculture is tied back to energy. So let's get to a place where we recognize that we need to lead the world when it comes to energy production, okay? So let's start there. That then leads to opportunity to reshore manufacturing, to grow business, things that are important to rural America, right? So that's where we're starting. Also, when we think about Congress, I hope that we're going to have opportunity to drive discussion about the intersection of energy security and property rights. We've been doing that with the conversation specific to Missouri on Grain Belt Express and the areas that that project will traverse. We've drove that discussion with regard to NETCs. So I'm hoping that as conversations happen within the administration and Congress, that we as agriculture have a seat at the table to talk about our role in not only producing energy, but the role that we play in housing projects and the need to better respect private property rights.
Well, Garrett Hawkins, we want to thank you for your passion and your service in agriculture, not only to run your operation, but also to lead from your community and to be a part of national leadership. Thank you for being on this edition of Open Mic. It is Open Mic, and you've got the last word.
I couldn't be more excited about the future of agriculture, Jeff. We certainly have challenges that are staring us in the face, but you know what? To be a part of this General Farm organization, to be a melting pot of thoughts and ideas, the opportunity is tremendous for us to work together to address these issues, always thinking about how we're going to bring the kids home and create opportunity that truly benefits this nation.
Our thanks to Garrett Hawkins, president of the Missouri Farm Bureau Federation, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by Syngenta, working with farmers to meet the challenges of the day. Learn more at syngenta-us.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Daly.